again. At first, Teo thought it was because Auntie never trusted her sheep herders, but later on he saw that she wanted to keep Josiah busy, too busy to go to Cubero. They had a good man working for them then, an Apache guy from White River, and he was probably the best sheep herder they ever had. But whenever she wanted to persuade Josiah to go check up on things, she would go into a long history of what the Apaches had done to the Pueblo people, dwelling especially on Geronimo. Once Robert heard her as he was leaving for the fields. He winked at Josiah and Teo, and then with a serious face he said, "I thought the sheep herder's name was Mike, not Geronimo," and walked out the door. As dry as it was, with the grass getting thin and short, Josiah said it was a good thing to check anyway, especially in case the river started drying up and they'd have to start hauling water to the sheep again, as they had during the dry years before. They took Mike some sugar and flour and a little coffee. He never had much to say to them, but Teo saw that he was reading some kind of book about auto mechanics. He took good care of the sheep in an offhand way, carrying the book around with him while he herded them. And when the old black mother dog had had pups, he had trained the best two for sheep dogs. Teo mentioned the book to Josiah, and he shook his head. "Well, he won't be around long then. Too bad. He's a good man." A week later, the Apache left for California, and they hired their cousin Pinky again. Auntie was against it because Pinky had blackout spells, and she said, "The whole herd of sheep could wander onto the tracks and get hit by the Santa Fe Super Jeep before Pinky woke up." They hired him anyway, and six sheep disappeared right after that during a dust storm, Pinky said, but he had a new harmonica and a blue pearl-button cowboy shirt they'd never seen before. All that summer, while Josiah and Teo watched the cattle and the sheep camp, and Robert worked in the fields each day, Rocky read magazines and ran laps at the baseball diamond twice a day. In the afternoons, he hitchhiked to Powhatan to see his girlfriend. Auntie made it clear to everyone that it was all necessary if Rocky were to keep his football scholarship to the university. But Teo knew that Rocky was already talking about the war and about joining the army before he got drafted. He would be the first one ever to get a football scholarship, the first one to go with no help from the BIA or anyone. She could hold her head up, she said, because of Rocky. And she looked hard at Josiah when she made the remark, as if to let him know that there were others who prevented her from carrying herself quite so proud. In the evenings, after they ate, Josiah would wash up, change his clothes, and go out again. Old Grandma was back in her chair beside the stove after all day outside under the elm tree, and she would listen carefully for Josiah to pour water into the tin basin. And she would say, "Aren't you going to rest, Josiah?" He dried his face and hands slowly without answering her because they both knew what she was really asking. When was this affair with the Mexican woman going to end? His hair was gray, but when he combed it and walked out the door, he was smiling, and his face wasn't tired or old. After he was gone, Auntie made an inaudible remark from the stove, where she kept her dishpan to keep the dishwater hot. She poured rinse water over the dishes so that they rattled together violently. She wiped them and put them in the cupboard, slamming the doors and dropping the frying pan down hard on top of the stove. This way they all knew she was angry. And all summer long, every night, they listened. Grandma never said anything about it. Teo didn't know when or how she had learned about it, or maybe she had known all along. They got into the habit of leaving before Josiah did, or right afterward. Robert left earlier, with the excuse that he had to chop wood or see how the little apple trees behind the house were doing. Rocky wasn't even there, because he ate most of his evening meals at Powhatan with his girlfriend's family. Auntie didn't care for that either, but Rocky was her special one, so all she said to him was, "How do you like living at Powhatan now?" looking angry as she said it. Teo got up to leave after he heard Josiah's truck pull out of the yard, but before he got out of the door, Auntie turned around and looked at him. She didn't seem to care if old Grandma heard what she said or not. "I was always happy he didn't get married," she said grimly. "But now, worse things are happening. The way he goes off every night reminds me of our old dog Pepper. That dog was the same way every time a female dog was in heat. Just like that. I try to tell him to stay with our own kind, but he doesn't listen to me. That woman is after everything she can get now."
Old Grandma nodded her head and said,
"That's right. That's what will happen." Auntie sat down on the bench by the table triumphantly. She folded and refolded the damp dishcloth on the table in front of her. Teo was aware of how dim the room was then, with no light except the faint twilight still coming in the windows. "Remember what happened to that dog?" She seemed to be talking to both of them, although Teo had never even seen Pepper. Her voice seemed to come from every part of the room. "Pepper got run over on the highway, chasing some she-dog in heat." He remembered when his mother died. It had been dry then, too. The day they buried her, the wind blew gusts of sand past the house and rattled the loose tin on the roof. He never forgot that sound and the sand stinging his face at the graveyard while he stood close to Josiah. He kept his head down, staring at small round pebbles uncovered by the wind. Josiah held his hand as they walked away from the graveyard. He lifted him into the front seat of the truck and gave him a candy cane left over from Christmas. He told him not to cry anymore. He knew the holy men had their ways during the dry spells. People said they climbed the trails to the mountaintops to look west and southwest and to call the clouds and thunder. They studied the night skies from the mountaintops and listened to the winds at dawn. When they came back down, they would tell the people it was time to dance for rain. Josiah never told him much about praying, except that it should be something he felt inside himself. So that last summer, before the war, he got up before dawn and rode the bay mare south to the spring in the narrow canyon. The water oozed out from the dark orange sandstone at the base of the long mesa. He waited for the sun to come over the hills. He tied the mare to a juniper tree at the mouth of the canyon and walked up the narrow trail, with the cliffs closer on both sides as he walked farther into the canyon. The canyon was full of shadows when he reached the pool. He had picked flowers along the path, flowers with yellow long petals the color of the sunlight. He shook the pollen from them gently and sprinkled it over the water. He laid the blossoms beside the pool and waited. He heard the water flowing into the pool drop by drop from the big crack in the side of the cliff. The things he did seemed right, as he imagined with his heart the rituals the cloud priests performed during a drought. Here the dust and heat began to recede. The short grass and stunted corn seemed distant. The air smelled damp, and it was cool even after the sun got high enough to shine into the canyon. The dark orange sandstone formation held springs like this one. All along the base of the sandstone where wind and erosion had cut narrow canyons into the rock. These springs came from deep within the earth, and the people relied upon them even when the sky was barren and the winds were hot and dusty. The spider came out first. She drank from the edge of the pool, careful to keep the delicate egg sacs on her abdomen out of the water. She retraced her path, leaving faint crisscrossing patterns in the fine yellow sand. He remembered stories about her. She waited in certain locations for people to come to her for help. She alone had known how to outsmart the malicious mountain Katsina, who imprisoned the rain clouds in the northwest room of his magical house. Spider Woman had told Sun Man how to win the storm clouds back from the gambler, so they would be free again to bring rain and snow to the people. He knew what white people thought about the stories. In school, the science teacher had explained what superstition was, and then held the science textbook up for the class to see the true source of explanations. He'd studied those books, and he had no reasons to believe the stories anymore. The science books explained the causes and effects. But old Grandma always used to say, "Back in time immemorial, things were different. The animals could talk to human beings, and many magical things still happened." He never lost the feeling he had in his chest when she spoke those words, as she did each time she told them stories. And he still felt it was true, despite all they had taught him in school, that long, long ago things had been different, and human beings could understand what the animals said. And once the gambler had trapped the storm clouds on his mountaintop. When the shadows were gone and the cliff rock began to get warm, the frogs came out of their sleeping places in small cracks and niches in the cliff above the pool. They were the color of the moss near the spring, and their backs were spotted the color of wet sand. They moved slowly into the sun, blinking their big eyes. He watched them dive into the pool, one by one, with a graceful, quiet sound. They swam across the pool to the sunny edge and sat there looking at him, snapping at the tiny insects that swarmed in the shade and grass around the pool. He smiled. They were the rain's children. He'd seen it happen many times after a rainstorm. In dried-up ponds and in the dry arroyo sands, even as the rain was still falling, they came popping up through the ground, with wet sand still on their backs. Josiah said they could stay buried in the dry sand for many years, waiting for the rain to come again. Dragonflies came and hovered over the pool. They were all colors of blue, powdery sky blue, dark night blue, shimmering with almost black iridescent light, and mountain blue. There were stories about the dragonflies, too. He turned. Everywhere he looked, he saw a world made of stories. The long-ago, time-immemorial stories, as old Grandma called them. It was a world alive, always changing and moving. And if you knew where to look, you could see it, sometimes almost imperceptible, like the motion of the stars across the sky. The horse was dozing under the tree. Her left hind foot was flexed and resting on the toe, the way horses did when they had to stand in one place for a long time. He rode slowly through the groves of dry sunflower stalks left over from better years, and it was then he saw a bright green hummingbird shimmering above the dry sandy ground, flying higher and higher until it was only a bright speck. Then it was gone. But it left something with him. As long as the hummingbird hadn't abandoned the land, somewhere there were still flowers, and they could all go on. The next day he watched the clouds gather on the west horizon. By the next morning, the sky was full of low, dark rain clouds. They loaded the shovels and hoes into the back of the truck and went to the fields. While they waited, they pulled weeds around the chili plants and shoveled dirt around the low places in the rows of corn where the water might be lost. When they stopped to eat the bread and tamales Auntie had packed for them, they could hear a low rumble of thunder in the distance, from the direction of Tsepina, Mount Taylor. The wind came up from the west, smelling cool like wet clay. Then he could see the rain. It was spinning out of the thunderclouds like gray spider webs and tangling against the foothills of the mountain. They joined the other people who had fields there by the main ditch, and nobody went back to work after lunch. They stood around, smiling and joking, keeping an eye on the clouds overhead while they waited. As the first big drops began to splatter down on the leaves of the corn plants, making loud, rattling sounds, Josiah motioned for Teo to walk to the truck with him. The rain made a steady thumping sound on the cab of the truck. Josiah wrote in the little spiral notebook he carried in his shirt pocket. He tore out the blue-lined page and folded it carefully. "Can you take this note to her? I told her I would come this afternoon and drive her to Grant's, but now with the rain I'll be too busy." Teo nodded. He could hear his heart beating, and he was breathing fast. Something was shaking in his belly. She had watched him all summer, whenever he had gone to Cubero with Josiah. She sat in the wicker rocking chair in the shade on the upstairs porch above the bar, and she stared down at him. She watched him while Josiah was inside buying a six-pack. Teo tried to avoid her eyes, but she was a patient woman. She watched him steadily, rocking slowly in the chair, waiting for him to sneak a quick glance at her. She smiled down at him until Josiah reached the top of the stairs. Then she smiled at Josiah and said, "You have a fine nephew, Joseo." Then she got up from the rocker and followed Josiah inside. His hands felt slippery on the steering wheel, and he felt as if every curve in the road was slowing him down and he might never reach the place. The sun was hidden by the clouds, and he wasn't aware any more of the color of the land. As he got closer, he was afraid she wouldn't be there. He shifted down to second gear and crossed the cattle guard by the old graveyard. He was close enough then to feel afraid, so he repeated over and over inside his head that he was only delivering a message, and she might not be there anyway. Raindrops splattered across the windshield like flying bugs hitting head-on. He wanted to turn around. He took his foot off the gas pedal and looked for a place to turn around, but the road was narrow, and on either side the ditches were muddy and flowing with the runoff. Up ahead he could see the big cottonwood tree. The rain rattled on the rusted tin roof, and rainwater leaked out of the rain gutter and splashed off the porch railing. He walked up the spiral staircase slowly, smelling wet adobe plaster, and listening to the rain rattle the waxy green cottonwood leaves growing near the porch. A scratchy Victrola was playing guitars and trumpets. A man sang sad Spanish words. "Y volveré" were the only words Teo could understand. He stood at the screen door and knocked, looking down at Josiah's note. He held it carefully because his hands were sweaty and he didn't want to smear the writing. He wiped his hands on the thighs of his Levi's while he waited. Nobody came to the door, but the music was playing loudly. He knocked on the screen door again, this time pounding it so hard that it bounced against the doorframe. He waited, breathing hard, and felt the sweat run down his ribs like rainwater. He decided to push the note under the screen door. She'd find it. He was kneeling to slide the note under the door when she came. He could smell her before he could even see her. The perfume smelled like the ivory locust blossoms that hung down from the trees in the spring. Her smell drifted out the screen on the air currents from the storm. The doorway at the back of the room had a long white curtain across it, and it swelled open as she came through. He looked at her through the sagging screen that had a fluffy ball of cotton stuck in the middle to scare the flies away. He saw her feet, the open-toe blue satin slippers and her painted toenails. The kimono was blue satin, and it wrapped around her closely, outlining her hips and belly. He stood up quickly and felt his face get hot. He held out the note. She smiled, but she didn't look at it. She looked at him. "Come in," she said. She pointed to a blue armchair with dark wooden feet carved like eagle claws. The room smelled like the white clay the people used for whitewash. It was cool. The curtain at the back of the room drifted in a cool stream of air from the window or door behind it. The music came from behind the curtain, too. The songs were soft and slow, without voices. Outside, the thunder sounded like giant boulders cracking loose from the high cliffs and crashing into narrow canyons. Sometimes the room shook, and the panes of glass in the window behind him rattled. He watched her read the note and wondered what she kept behind the curtains. He could feel something back there, something of her life which he couldn't explain. The room pulsed with feeling. The feeling flowing with the music and the breeze from the curtains, feeling colored by the blue flowers painted in a border around the walls. He could feel it everywhere, even in the blue sheets that were stretched tightly across the bed. Somewhere, from another room, he heard a clock ticking slowly and distinctly, as if the years, the centuries, were lost in that sound. The rain pounded louder on the tin roof, and she looked up from the note then at the screen door and the cottonwood tree outside, its leaves beaten flat by the downpour. The kimono was open slightly at the neck, and he could see the light brown color of her skin. Her long brown hair was curled and piled on her head in long ringlets, the style of some past time. She didn't look old or young to him then. She was like the rain and the wind. Age had no relation to her. She got up from the edge of the bed and hooked the screen door. She closed the door and pushed the bolt forward. The music had stopped, and there was only the sound of the storm. He dreamed it again and again, sinking and rolling with the light blue sheets twisted around his thighs and ankles, and the excitement of wet smells of rain and their sweat. He wanted to lie like that forever. She whispered in Spanish and touched him gently, rubbing his back and neck first, and brushing his ear and neck with her lips. She pressed against his chest and belly, and he clenched himself tight until he felt the warmth and softness of her legs and belly. Her sounds were gentle, and the storm outside was loud. He could hear the rain rattling the roof and the sound of the old cottonwood tree straining in the wind. He moved his mouth over her face and slowly opened his eyes. She was smiling. He felt her shiver, and when he held her closer, he realized he was shaking too. Something was coiling tight. She breathed harder, and he breathed with the same rhythm. She slid beneath him then, like a cat squeezing under a gate. She moved under him, her rhythm merging into the sound of the wind shaking the rafters and the sound of the rain in the tree. And he was lost somewhere, deep beneath the surface of his own body and consciousness, swimming away from all his life before that hour. She sat with the sheets pulled around her and watched him get dressed. "I have been watching you for a long time," she said. "I saw the color of your eyes." Teo didn't look at her. "Mexican eyes," he said. "The other kids used to tease me." The rain was only a faint sound on the roof, and the sound of the thunder was distant and moving east. Teo unbolted the door and opened it. He watched the rainwater pour out the rain gutter over the side of the long porch. "I always wished I had dark eyes like other people. When they look at me, they remember things that happened. My mother." His throat felt tight. He hadn't talked about this before with anyone. She shook her head slowly. "They are afraid, Teo. They feel something happening. They can see something happening around them, and it scares them. Indians or Mexicans or whites, most people are afraid of change. They think that if their children have the same color of skin, the same color of eyes, that nothing is changing." She laughed softly. "They are fools. They blame us, the ones who look different. That way they don't have to think about what has happened inside themselves." She was looking at him intently, and he felt uncomfortable. He walked over to the doorway, aware of the damp earth smell outside. He had one hand on the screen door, ready to leave. "You don't have to understand what is happening, but remember this day. You will recognize it later. You are part of it now." She was looking up at the pine vigas that held the roof. She turned her head and smiled at him. "Mateo," she said softly, and he felt that she cared a great deal about him. "Goodbye," he said. He pushed the screen door open into the cool, damp air outside. "Goodbye, Teo. Thank you for bringing the message." He left Harley holding a bottle of Coors in both hands, talking to himself. He walked west. He could see the peaks of Mount Taylor high above everything, high above the valley. The thin winter snow was already gone from the high peaks, and the sacred mountain was a dusty, dry blue color. He could feel the heat from the ground through his boots, and shimmering waves of heat dance around him from the pavement, making him shaky, as though he were walking in a strong wind. The trucks and cars that went speeding past him made ripples in the heavy blanket of heat, but the air that circulated was only slightly cooler. The old Mexican man brought him a bowl of menudo. They were alone in the little café. Teo could see through the narrow kitchen to the back door, which was propped open with a chair so that cool air could find its way in and the hot air could leave by the front door, which was also open. On both screen doors, the flies sat rubbing their legs together, waiting to get inside. The old man sat on a stool by the front door with a red rubber fly swatter in his right hand, watching them. Occasionally, he glanced up at the low plaster ceiling, where a half-dozen shiny yellow fly ribbons were hanging like party decorations. The ribbons were speckled with dead flies, and a few that made feeble attempts to pull loose. He paid the old man and left, opening the screen door only enough to squeeze out and closing it quickly so that no flies got in. The sun was behind the hills southwest of McCarty's by then, and he walked with the long shadows back to the bar to find Harley. He was thinking about the time when he was young and swatting flies in the kitchen with a willow switch because it was fun to chase them, not the serious business that the old Mexican man had made fly-killing. Anyway, Josiah had come in from outside, and he asked Teo what he was doing, and Teo had pointed proudly to a pile of dead flies on the kitchen floor. Josiah looked at them and shook his head. "But our teacher said so. She said they're bad and carry sickness."
"Well, I didn't go to school much, so I don't know about that, but you see, long time ago, way back in the time immemorial, the mother of the people got angry at them for the way they were behaving. For all she cared, they could go to hell, starve to death. The animals disappeared, the plants disappeared, and no rain came for a long time. It was the green bottle fly who went to her, asking forgiveness for the people. Since that time, the people have been grateful for what the fly did for us." Teo let the willow switch slide out of his hand. He stared at it on the floor by his feet.
"What will happen now?"
he asked in a choked voice. "I think it'll be okay," Josiah said, poking at the dead flies with the toe of his boot. "None of them were green bottle flies, only some of his cousins. People make mistakes. The flies know that. That's how the green bottle fly first came around, anyway, to help the people who had made some mistakes." He hugged the boy close. "Next time, just remember the story." But in the jungle, he hadn't been able to endure the flies that had crawled over Rocky. They had enraged him. He had cursed their sticky feet and wet mouths, and when he could reach them, he had smashed them between his hands. Harley wasn't there. The Mexican bartender had gone home, and now the white man who owned the place was behind the bar, dusting off the bottles with a rag. Teo stood in the door and looked around inside, at the empty tables with crooked legs of different lengths. Someone had swept the floor, and the beer bottles and cigarette butts were piled high in the middle next to the broom leaning against the back of a chair. The stale bar air followed him out the door, smelling like old cigarette smoke and spilled beer. He stood outside facing the south, but all his feelings were focused behind him, northeast, in the direction of Cubero. He turned around. The yellow sandstone outcrop ran parallel to the big arroyo behind the bar. All he had to do was follow it. He walked to Cubero in the twilight, looking up occasionally at the mountain where the peaks were caught in the sunset. It was warm. Over on the highway, he could see headlights and taillights moving east and west, but he felt alone, as if that world were distant from him. No traffic came along the dirt road, and it was quiet except for the crickets in the rocks and a few evening insects buzzing past his face. In the distance, dogs were barking. The store in Cubero was closed, and the gas pumps had locks on the handles. Somewhere he smelled chili cooking for supper. The road past the store was empty, except for an old cow with a broken horn hanging near her face.
he didn't have to turn around to see the sunset. The reflection of its colors made the sandstone cliffs bright gold and then deep red. He sat on the steps of the long porch and looked at the adobe walls for a long time. Years of rain and wind had weathered away the adobe plaster, exposing the symmetry of the brown adobes which were beginning to lose their square shape, taking on the softer contours of the mesas and hills. He remembered sitting this way on these steps with Rocky, while Josiah went inside Lalo's to get cold beer and bottles of soda pop for them. Lalo had retired during the war. He had sold the liquor license and closed the bar, but it had changed very little. The circular stairs were still there at the end of the long porch. They had been cut from heavy oak planks, and they spiraled around the massive center timber like the small bones of a spine held in place by thick wooden pegs. Years of hands on the railing and feet on the steps had left the wood polished smooth and bone gray. The big tree was dying. Thick limbs at its center were brittle and white. One of the remaining live limbs brushed against the porch railing at the top of the stairs. He smelled the waxy dark green leaves and remembered climbing the big cottonwood trees along the river and plucking heavy hanging bunches of cottonwood berries that grew on the female trees late in the summer. They had carried home armloads of the seed pods, the size of peas, full of fluffy cotton when they split open. The smell of the crushed leaves had been exciting then because the cottonwood berries were ammunition to use against the other boys from the village, who tucked their shirt tails into their jeans and filled the inside of their shirts with cottonwood berries until they had pendulous bellies. Then they ran, laughing and throwing handfuls of the green berries at one another. The cottonwood trees hadn't lost their familiar feeling with him. They had always been there with the people, but they were much more than summer shade. After hundreds of years, when the great trees finally got too old and dry, the Katsina carvers from the villages came searching for them to cut pieces of their soft, dry wood to carve. He sat down on the upstairs porch with his back against the adobe wall and closed his eyes. In a world of crickets and wind and cottonwood trees, he was almost alive again. He was visible. The green waves of dead faces and the screams of the dying that had echoed in his head were buried. The sickness had receded into a shadow behind him, something he saw only out of the corners of his eyes, over his shoulder. The place felt good. He leaned back against the wall until its surface pushed against his backbone solidly. He picked up a fragment of fallen plaster and drew dusty white stripes across the backs of his hands, the way ceremonial dancers sometimes did, except they used white clay and not old plaster. It was soothing to rub the dust over his hands. He rubbed it carefully across his light brown skin, the stark white gypsum dust making a spotted pattern. And then he knew why it was done by the dancers. It connected them to the earth. He became aware of the place then, of where he was. He had never seen her again after that day. The summer kept them busy, and by early September he and Rocky had enlisted and were gone. They said that she left after Josiah's funeral, and nobody knew where she went, only that she walked to the highway with a suitcase. The screen door was propped open against the side of the building with a large round sand rock. He expected the door to be locked when he turned the cut glass knob, but it swung open. The room was empty. His steps inside sounded hollow, like a sandstone cave in the cliffs. The floor was covered with a layer of fine brown dust that had pushed under the door and between the walls and the window sash. The dust drifted up in little clouds around his feet. The white curtains were gone, and he could see through the doorway to a small back room. Whatever had been there, the music, the currents of air that had moved so restlessly that day, was gone. He looked for some signs of what had been there, but all that was left was a hole in the ceiling where the stovepipe had been. He stood in the dim gray light, watching the darkness push between him and the bare room. He breathed deeply, trying to find a trace of the locust blossom perfume, but all he smelled was the white clay plaster, as timeless as the cliffs where it came from. He walked all the way to Casablanca, listening to the crickets scattered around him like the stars. He climbed the old ladder into the loft of the barn behind Harley's grandpa's house. It was a warm night. He lay down in the old hay, and he slept all night without dreams. Fly started sucking on sweet things, so Hummingbird had to tell him to wait. Wait until we see our mother. They found her. They gave her blue pollen and yellow pollen. They gave her turquoise beads. They gave her prayer sticks. "I suppose you want something," she said. "Yes, we want food and storm clouds. You get old Buzzard to purify your town first, and then maybe I will send you people food and rain again." Fly and Hummingbird flew back up. They told the town people that old Buzzard had to purify the town. "I'm feeling better," Teo said. "I've been doing okay. I can start helping you now." He poured Robert a cup of coffee and carried it over to the table. His hands were shaking when he set the cup down. Robert didn't say anything. He stirred the sugar into the coffee slowly, silently, as if getting ready to say something. Maybe there would always be those shadows over his shoulder and out of the corner of each eye, and in the nights, the dreams and the voices. Maybe there was nothing anyone could do for him. Robert looked up at him. "The other day, old man Kuush came to the house. He told your grandma what some of the old men are thinking. They think you better get help pretty soon." "But I haven't been in trouble for a long time. Not since that time with Emo." "I know, but there are other things, too." "Oh." Teo knew. There were other things. "It isn't just me, Robert. The other guys, they're still messed up, too. That ceremony didn't help them." Robert didn't answer. His face was still. Teo didn't know the last few minutes if it was anger or sadness he saw. He got up from the table slowly. All his energy had drained out of him. "I'll go," he said softly. "Whatever they say." The old feeling was back again. He wanted to fade until he was as flat as his own hand looked, flat like a drawing in the sand which didn't speak or move, waiting for the wind to come swirling along the ground and blow the lines away. He could hear what Auntie would have to say. He could see her rigid face, her jaws clenched against the things which were being said about him in the village. He would let them take him, whatever they wanted, because they were right. They'd always been right about him. "The traveling made me tired, but I remember when we drove through Gallup. I saw Navajos and torn old jackets standing outside the bars. There were Zunis and Hopis there, too, even a few Lagunas. All of them slouched down against the dirty walls of the bars along Highway 66, their eyes staring at the ground as if they had forgotten the sun in the sky. Or maybe that was the way they dreamed for wine, looking for it somewhere in the mud on the sidewalk. This is us, too," I was thinking to myself. "These people crouching outside bars like cold flies stuck to the wall." They parked the truck by the Trailways bus station and walked across the railroad tracks. It was still early in the morning, and the shadows around the warehouses and buildings were long. The streets were empty, and on a Saturday morning in Gallup, Teo knew what they would see. From the doorway of a second-hand store, he could see feet, toes poking through holes in the socks. Someone sleeping off the night before, but without his boots now, because somebody had taken them to trade for a bottle of cheap wine. The guy had his head against the door. His brown face was peaceful, and he was snoring loudly. Teo smiled. Gallup was that kind of place. Interesting, even funny, as long as you were just passing through, the way the white tourists did driving down 66, stopping to see the Indian souvenirs. But if you were an Indian, you attended to business and then left. And you were never in that town after dark. That was the warning the old Zunis and Hopis and Navajos had about Gallup. The safest way was to avoid bad places after dark. The best time to see them was at dawn, because after the sun came up they would be hiding or sleeping inside shelters of old tin, cardboard, and scrap wood. The shelters were scattered along the banks of the river. Some of them were in the wide arroyo that the creek cut through Gallup, but others were in the salt cedar and willow thickets that grew along the stream banks. Twice, or maybe three times a year, the police and the welfare people made a sweep along the river, arresting the men and women for vagrancy and being drunk in public, and taking the children away to the home. They were on the north side of the town, anyway, Little Africa, where blacks, Mexicans, and Indians lived, and the only white people over there were Slav storekeepers. They came at Gallup ceremonial time to clean up before the tourists came to town. They talked about sanitation and safety as they dragged the people to the paddy wagons. In July and August, sudden cloudbursts could fill the arroyos with flood water and wash the shelters away. They'd been born in Gallup. They were the ones with light-colored hair or light eyes, bushy hair and thick lips, the ones the women were ashamed to send home for their families to raise. Those who didn't die grew up by the river, watching their mothers leave at sundown. They learned to listen in the darkness, to the sounds of footsteps and loud laughing, to voices and sounds of wine, to know when the mother was returning with a man. They learned to stand at a distance and see if she would throw them food, so they would go away to eat and not peek through the holes in the rusting tin at the man spilling wine on himself as he unbuttoned his pants. They found their own places to sleep because the men stayed until dawn. Before they knew how to walk, the children learned how to avoid fists and feet. When she woke up at noon, she would call the child to bring her water. The lard pail was almost empty. The water looked rusty. He waited until she crawled to the opening. He watched her throat moving up and down as she drank. He tried to look inside to see if she had brought food, but the sun was high now and the inside of the shelter was in shadow. She dropped the pail when it was empty and crawled back inside. "Ma," he called to her because he was hungry and he had found no food that morning. The woman with the reddish-colored hair, the one who used to feed him, was gone. Her shelter was already torn down, taken away in pieces by others in the arroyo. He had prowled for garbage in the alleys behind the houses, but the older children had already been there. He turned away from the shelter and looked up at the traffic on the bridge. Once he had crawled up there and stood on the bridge, looking down at the shelter, and then around at the street where it crossed the tracks. He could even see downtown. She had taken him with her when he was very small. He remembered the brightness of the sun, the heat, all the smells of cars and food cooking, the noise and the people. He remembered the inside, the dark, the coolness, and the music. He lay on his belly with his chin on the wooden floor and watched the legs and shoes under the tables, the legs moving across the floor. Some moved slowly, some stumbled. He searched the floor until he found a plastic bar straw, and then he played with piles of cigarette butts he had gathered. When he found chewing gum stuck beneath the tables, he put it in his mouth and tried to keep it, but he always swallowed it. He couldn't remember when he first knew that cigarettes would make him vomit if he ate them. He played for hours under the tables, quiet, watching for someone to drop a potato chip bag or a wad of gum. He learned about coins and searched for them, putting them in his mouth when he found them. Once they had lived somewhere else, a place full of food. He dreamed about that place in the past, and about a red blanket that was warm and moved rhythmically, like breathing. He got used to her leaving the bar with men, giving somebody a dollar to buy the boy food while she was out. After he ate, he slept under the tables and waited for her to come back. The first time she didn't come back, the man who swept the floors found him. He didn't cry when the man woke him. He didn't cry when the police came and tried to ask him his name. He clutched the last piece of bread in his hand and crouched in the corner. He closed his eyes when they reached for him. After a long time, she came for him. She smelled good when she carried him, and she spoke softly. But the last time, he remembered the white walls and the rows of cribs. He cried for a long time, standing up in the bed with his chin resting on the top rail. He chewed the paint from the top rail, still crying, but gradually becoming interested in the way the paint peeled off the metal and clung to his front teeth. When she came for him, she smelled different. She smelled like the floors of the room full of cribs, and her long hair had been cut. But she came back for him, and she held him very close. They stayed in the arroyo after that. The woman with the reddish hair helped them drag twisted pieces of old roof tin from the dump, down the banks of the river to the place the other shacks were, in sight of the bridge. They leaned the tin against the crumbly gray sides of the arroyo. His mother rolled big bricks up from the riverbed to hold the pieces of cardboard in place. It was cold then, and when the sun went down, they built small fires from broken crates they found in the alleys, and with branches they tore from the tamarack and willow. The willows and tamaracks were almost bare then, except for the branches higher than a man could reach. One of the men brought an axe with a broken handle, and the drunks who lived in the arroyo chopped down the tamaracks and willows, laughing and passing a bottle around as they took turns with the axe. The only trees they didn't cut down were the ones the people used. A strong, stinging smell came from that place. He learned to watch out for shit, and in the winter, when it was frozen, he played with it, flipping it around with a willow stick. He didn't play with the other children. He ran from them when they approached. They belonged to the woman who stayed under the bridge, with low tin walls to block the west wind. That winter he heard a strange crying sound coming from under the bridge, and he saw the children standing outside the low sides of the shelter, watching. He listened for a long time and watched. The next day it was quiet, and the woman carried a bundle of bloody rags away from the bridge, far away north, toward the hills. Later on he walked the way she had gone, following the arroyo east and then north, where it wound into the pale yellow hills. He found the place near the side of the arroyo where she had buried the rags in the yellow sand. The sand she had dug with her hands was still damp on the mound. He circled the mound and stared at a faded blue rag partially uncovered, quivering in the wind. It was stiff with a reddish-brown stain. He left that place and he never went back. And late at night, when his mother was gone, he cried because he saw the mound of pale yellow sand in a dream. Damp yellow sand choking him, filling his nostrils first, and then his eyes as he struggled against it, fought to keep his eyes open to see. Sand rippled and swirled in his dream, enclosing his head, yellow sand and shadows filling his mouth until his body was full and still. He woke up crying in a shallow hole beside the clay bank where his mother had thrown the old quilt. He slept alone while his mother was with the men, the white men with necks and faces bright red from the summertime, Mexican men who came from the section gang boxcars at the railroad, looking for the women who waited around the bridge, the ones who would go down for a half bottle of wine. The black men came from the railroad tracks, too, to stand on the bridge and look down at them. He didn't know if they looked at him or if they were only looking at his mother and the women who lined up beside her, to smile and wave and yell, "Hey, honey!" up to the men. The white people who drove by looked straight ahead, but late one afternoon, some white men came and called until the women came out of the lean-tos, and then the men yelled at them and threw empty bottles, trying to hit them. The woman with the reddish hair threw the bottles back at them and screamed their own words back to them. The police came. They dragged the people out of their shelters, and they pulled the pieces of tin and cardboard down. The police handcuffed the skinny men with swollen faces. They pushed and kicked them up the crumbling clay sides of the arroyo. They held the women in a circle while they tried to catch the children who had scattered in all directions when they saw the police coming. The men and the women who were too sick drunk to stand up were dragged away, one cop on each arm. He hid in the tamaracks, breathing hard, his heart pounding, smelling the shit on his bare feet. The summer heat descended as the sun went higher in the sky, and he watched them, lying flat on his belly in the dry leaves of tamarack that began to make him itch, and he moved cautiously to scratch his arm and his neck. He watched them tear down the last of the shelters, and they piled the rags and coats they found and sprinkled them with kerosene. Thick black smoke climbed furiously into the cloudless blue sky, hot and windless. He could feel the flies buzzing and crawling around his legs and feet, and he was afraid that the men searching would hear them and find him. But the smell in the remaining grove of tamarack and willow was strong enough to keep them away. The men in dark green coveralls came with steel canisters on their backs, and they sprayed the places where the shelters had been. And in the burned smell of cloth and wood, he could smell the long white halls of the place they kept children. At sundown he woke up and caught sight of the headlights on the traffic across the bridge. He stood up slowly and looked restlessly toward the arroyo banks, thinking about food. It was a warm night, and he wandered for a long time in the alleys behind the houses, where the dogs barked when he reached into the tin cans. He ate as he made his way back to the arroyo, chewing the soft bone cartilage of pork ribs he found. He saved the bones and sucked them until he went to sleep in the tamaracks and willows. Late in the night he heard voices, men stumbling and falling down the steep crumbling bank into the arroyo, and he could hear bottles rattle together and the sound of corks being pulled from the bottles. They talked loudly in the language his mother spoke to him, and one man sat with his back against the bank and sang songs until the wine was gone. He crawled deeper into the tamarack bushes and pulled his knees up to his belly. He looked up at the stars through the top branches of the willows. He would wait for her, and she would come back to him. They took more pollen, more beads, and more prayer sticks, and they went to see Old Buzzard. They arrived at his place in the east.
"Who's out there? Nobody ever came here before."
"It's us, Hummingbird and Fly."
"Oh, what do you want?"
"We need you to purify our town."
"Well, look here, your offering isn't complete. Where's the tobacco?"
You see, it wasn't easy. Fly and Hummingbird had to fly back to town again. Robert and Teo stopped on the bridge and looked into the riverbed. It had been dry for a long time, and there were paths in the sand where the people walked. They were beginning to move. All along the sandy clay banks there were people, mostly men, stretched out, sleeping, some of them face down where they fell, and a few rolled over on their backs or on their sides, sleeping with their heads on their arms. The sun was getting hot, and the flies were beginning to come out. They could see them buzzing around the face of a man under the bridge, smelling the sweetness of the wine, or maybe the vomit down the front of the man's shirt. Robert shook his head. Teo felt the choking in his throat. He blinked his eyes hard and didn't say anything. A man and woman came walking down the wash below them and looked up at them on the bridge.
"Hey, buddy," the man yelled up. "You got a dollar you can loan us?"
Robert looked at them and shook his head calmly, but Teo started to sweat. He started reaching deep into his pockets for loose coins. The woman's hair was tangled in hairpins, which had been pulled loose and hung around her head like ornaments. Her head weaved from side to side as she squinted and tried to focus on Teo up above her. Her slip was torn and dragging the ground under her skirt. She had a dark bruise on her forehead. He found 2 quarters and tossed them into the man's outstretched hands, swaying above his head, and both the man and woman dropped to their knees in the sand to find them. Robert walked away, but Teo stood there, remembering the little bridge in a park in San Diego where all the soldiers took their dates the night before they shipped out to the South Pacific and stood throwing coins into the shallow pond. He had tossed the coins to them the way he had tossed them from the bridge in San Diego, in a gentle, slow arc. Rocky wished out loud that night for a safe return from the war, but Teo couldn't remember his wish. He watched them stumble and crawl up the loose clay of the steep riverbank. The man pulled the woman up the last few feet. The fly of his pants was unbuttoned, and one of his shoes was flopping loose on his foot. They walked toward a bar south of the bridge to wait for it to open. They walked like survivors, with dull, vacant eyes, their fists clutching the coins he'd thrown to them. They were Navajos, but he had seen Zunis and Lagunas and Hopis there, too, walking alone or in twos and threes along the dusty Gallup streets. He didn't know how they got there in the first place, from the reservation to Gallup, but some must have had jobs for a while when they first came, and cheap rooms on the north side of the tracks, where they stayed until they got laid off or fired. Reservation people were the first ones to get laid off because white people in Gallup already knew they wouldn't ask any questions or get angry. They just walked away. They were educated only enough to know they wanted to leave the reservation. When they got to Gallup, there weren't many jobs they could get. The men unloaded trucks in the warehouses near the tracks, or piled lumber in the lumber yards, or pushed wheelbarrows for construction. The women cleaned out motel rooms along Highway 66. The Gallup people knew they didn't have to pay good wages or put up with anything they didn't like, because there were plenty more Indians where these had come from. It seemed to Teo that they would go home sooner or later when they were hungry and dirty and broke. Stand on 666 north of town and wait for someone driving to Keams Canyon or Lukachukai to stop, or borrow $2 and ride the bus back to Laguna. But Gallup was a dangerous place, and by the time they realized what had happened to them, they must have believed it was too late to go home. Robert was waiting for him on the hill.
"Somebody you used to know?"
"Maybe," Teo said. The sun was above them now in a deep blue sky like good turquoise. He looked back at the bridge, and he made a wish. The same wish Rocky made that night in San Diego. A safe return. "What kind of medicine man lives in a place like that, in the foothills north of the ceremonial grounds?" Auntie wanted to know. Grandma told her, "Never mind. Old man Koosh knows him, and he thinks this man Batoni might help him." The Gallup ceremonial had been an annual event for a long time. It was good for the tourist business coming through in the summertime on Highway 66. They liked to see Indians and Indian dances. They wanted a chance to buy Indian jewelry and Navajo rugs. Every year it was organized by the white men there. Turpin, Fouts, Kennedy, and the mayor. Dance groups from the Pueblos were paid to come. They got plains hoop dancers and flying pole dancers from northern Mexico. They organized an all-Indian rodeo and horse races. And the people came, from all the reservations nearby, and some came from farther away. They brought their things to sell to the tourists, and they brought things to trade with each other. White deer hides and feathers, and dried meat or peaky bread. The tourists got to see what they wanted. From the grandstand at the ceremonial grounds, they watched the dancers perform, and they watched Indian cowboys ride bucking horses and Brahma bulls. There were wagon races and the ladies' wood-chopping contest and fry bread-making race. The Gallup merchants raised prices in motels and restaurants all ceremonial week, and made a lot of money off the tourists. They sold great amounts of liquor to Indians, and in those years, when liquor was illegal for Indians, they made a lot more money because they bootlegged it. Old Batoni's place looked down on all of it. From the yellow sandrock foothills, the whole town spread out below. The old man was tall, and his chest was wide. At one time he had been heavier, but old age was consuming everything but the bones. He kept his hair tied back neatly with red yarn in a chongo knot, like the old-timers wore. He was sitting on an old tin bucket turned upside down by the doorway to his hogan. When he stood up and extended his hand to Robert and Teo, his motions were strong and unhesitating, as if they belonged to a younger man. He watched Teo look around at the hogan and then back down at the ceremonial grounds and city streets in the distance. He nodded his head at Teo.
"People ask me why I live here," he said in good English. "I tell them I want to keep track of the people." "Why over here?" they ask me. "Because this is where Gallup keeps Indians until ceremonial time. Then they want to show us off to the tourists."
He looked down at the riverbed winding through the north side of Gallup.
"There," he said, pointing his chin at the bridge. "They sleep over there."